Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 97-year-old Durrell Gibbs of Fort Benton, Montana, a survivor of the Battle of Okinawa with the 96th Infantry Division's 381st Regiment, I Company to be exact. When we left off, Private Gibbs was heading overseas, and I'm always curious what the true expectations are in situations like this. You remember having any thoughts or questions maybe about whether or not you'd make it home from this war?
No, I don't remember even thinking about that. There was so much going on, many incidents, little incidents that happened to, maybe didn't happen to the guy next to me, but they happened to me or and vice versa. You know, like one time I remember it was kind of rough and it was a little nicer being out on the deck than it was down the hole. We'd have six men. Our bunks, you'd climb, go up the bunks. It was just a pipe. Canvas would be laced in there and you'd slide in sideways to your bunk. And the guy in front of you would be about a foot. You had a foot of clearance and you was about a foot below you, there'd be another guy. There was, I don't know, five or six. Well, you don't spend too much time on your bunk. It's a lot better up on the deck and the breeze are blowing. So they had some barrels, 55-gallon drums, laced there by the side, and I felt a little tired, and I didn't want to go down to my bunk. So I just laid on, there's half a dozen or so barrels there, and I just laid on top of those barrels and dozed off. In the meantime, the ship got pretty rough, and there was nothing would keep me from rolling off the barrels. If I rolled one way, I'd hit the deck, and if I rolled the other way, I'd drop off the ship. And here I napped for, an hour or so. And when I woke up, that ship was really rocking, and I looked right over my, right there. Nothing kept me from rolling that way, and I'd have dropped off the ship. Just little things like that stay with you. But I didn't think about anything. I didn't worry about a fight or what would happen when. I don't recall thinking about it until it was there.
Until you got to Okinawa. And, you know, people that know the timeline know Okinawa was the last major battle in the Pacific. But did you all have an idea of how the war was going? Did you think it was getting close to the end? Or was that not even a thought in your mind?
Oh, no. The way it worked, when Okinawa fell at the end of the fight in Okinawa, the division moved to an island in the Philippines, Mindoro. We knew then, when we went to Mindoro, there you get all the strength built back up, and we'd do our regular calisthenics, all our practice. We would use old tanks from airplanes that had been crashed and wrecked, and we'd fix a shower and stuff. We had all that kind of stuff there that we just put together ourselves. And while the division was getting back to strength, and then word come down that the LSTs, the ships, were there, and we was about 15 miles from the ocean, so the equipment was all loaded, and then we was going to load the next morning early to hit Japan. And the 96th was slated to be one of the divisions to hit Japan right off. The next morning, we was with our bunks, was just folding cots. And there was 12 men to a tent, a big tent. And we struck those tents that night and folded them up and loaded them on trucks. We just slept out that night. Next morning, we was going to make that march to the ocean and load the ships and was going to hit Japan. That next morning we got up early. The news had come down that the Japanese had surrendered. So the tents come back, and until they seen what we was going to do, the 96th Infantry Division was not a regular division. It was a division that was put up after Pearl Harbor. So it was going to be, I guess, the 96, it'd be everybody would go home and there wouldn't be a 96 division anymore. And news come down. They come down with a program where if you wanted to sign up in the regular Army, they called us Red Apple Boys for regular Army. If you wanted to sign up for that Red Apple program for 1 year, and I did. I signed up for 1 year. They sent us home on an extended furlough. I thought maybe a month or something like that. Then I reported back to Seattle. It was always at Seattle. And I went back to Okinawa with with military government. And I was in the public health department. And I was listed as a typist in the office there. It just so happened that the colonel was a surgeon, and he had seen combat. And I was about the only one there that had seen combat. And he seen my record, and I told him, I said, Colonel O'Brien, an Irishman, I told him, I said, hell, I can't write my name on a typewriter. And he laughed. And so I wound up with, I was in charge of all the alcohol that we were setting up medical dispensaries for the civilians, for the people, the doctors and stuff. And I was in charge of seeing that they had all the alcohol, whatever alcohol they needed. And I had two interpreters and a Jeep. And I kept that Jeep just like it was my own vehicle. And that's how I spent my last year in Okinawa, right back where I seen it tore apart. And then it was part of the program that put it back together.
Well, and I've got a lot of questions about some of what you shared, but I don't want to get lost time-wise and neglect to come back to the actual battle for Okinawa. Had you ever heard of Okinawa before you got there? Did you know what you guys were getting into?
No. Mm-mm. We were just there. The division was there, and I come in whenever your manpower gets down, you know, they keep the division as up to speed, so to speak, with the manpower. That's when I joined when I was sent into the 96th Infantry Division on Okinawa.
Tell me what you remember about that, your first experiences coming ashore, what they had you do, where they had you go. Take us back there if you can.
Well, the division was already on Okinawa, but when we come to Okinawa, when we got there, it was dark. And they have a big, heavy rope. It's like a mat, only, you know, they throw them it throws over the edge of the ship. You go down that like it's, I don't know hardly how to describe it, like a web, you know, and you can either climb up it or go down it. Well, and they had these landing craft would pull up right again the side of the ship, and we'd go down that and get into that landing craft. That landing craft was up and down probably 4 or 5 feet, you know, up and down with the waves of in the ocean. And steel helmets, and there'd be one guy climbing or going down. It was just like ants going. It was just all so new and kind of exciting. And you were just doing what a lot of other guys around you was doing. So, and then the landing craft would go in and the front end would drop down. They'd go in with the landing craft until it hit the sand, you know, the bottom. And probably when you got out, you'd be in water up from your knees maybe something or to your waist. You'd just get in there and find whatever protection you know, for cover. And it was usually, if I remember right, it was probably 12 men to a squad. You had that sergeant, he would give you any directions, he would give the orders, he was the 12 men. We formed in those squads and in those big tents when we were building up strength on Mindoro. Everything was first, second, or third squad. And that's how you got your orders and kept order.
So on Okinawa, again, so much of this is new to you. What was your first real taste of combat, or what this new thing was going to be like?
Well, you know, real foliage was real heavy on Okinawa. But there was so much shelling going on. By the time Okinawa, the Air Force had complete control of the air. The only Jap planes we seen was, what do they call them, when they fly them into a ship and try to sink the ship, kamikaze. And those were the only Jap planes we seen. But the big guns, we just hear those shells coming, and you got so that you could, the first, you'd hear a high-pitched squeak, just a high-pitched whine. And the closer that shell got to you, the higher that pitch got. One night I was, and this was happened kind of soon, we hadn't went too far. We was pushing in, and who knows what you're going to run into until you get there. And the sniper fire, so 1 minute you'd hear some shots and you'd be under sniper fire. And then pretty quick, that wouldn't be there anymore, and you'd try to move out and get, we're taking a hill. It seemed like we was always fighting for a hill, for the high ground. And you never knew. You could hear the shots. You didn't know where they was coming from. And you'd get up sooner, and if you seen a Jap, you tried to shoot him just like he was trying to shoot you. And that way, you was either gaining ground, or if you couldn't gain ground, you dug in. Every night, we dug a foxhole wherever we was at. And, of course, everything was in order. We dug the foxhole, and that's how we'd spend the night. And, of course, the size of the foxhole depended on how hard it was to dig. And but we tried to get 3 feet. We would try to get 3 feet. Sometimes it'd be two, and you had to. You wouldn't dig it any bigger. There's always two men to a foxhole. It depend on how hard it was and how far you dug. But one of the experiences I had, I mean, you just took everything as it come. You was there fighting, and that's the way it was. And you remember incidents, you know, and that's what I remember. That's what I'm telling now. There was an incident where I was digging the foxhole. I had that radio that kept us in contact with the company, and I didn't have any radio experience. It was just everybody done what they had to do under the circumstances. And it was a walkie-talkie deal. And that darn radio, you know, you had to push, and then you could talk, and then you let up, and they could respond. Mm-hmm. And that's what kept us hooked up with the company. And so I happened to fall heir to the radio one time, because if a radio man got shot, man, whoever was closest to that radio, we had to get that radio. Sure. And that darn radio had a 3-foot antenna, so nobody wanted it, but somebody had to have it.
And you didn't want it because a 3-foot antenna is pretty noticeable and makes you a bigger target?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so I had that darn radio, and the radio man had to be right with the sergeant that was head of the squad, and because he would relay messages back and forth from the company. Command was back a little ways behind the lines. That darn radio was just, I was right there by the sergeant all the time, and he was a go-getter. We wound up getting awarded the Bronze Star, and it must have been for the fight. I mean, you never knew. You just took every day as it come. I don't know what specific action generated that Bronze Star.
Were you starting to tell me about something with the radio? Did you end up with a close call because you had the radio? Is that where you were going with that?
Oh, well, yeah. We were dug in for the night, and this is what started all this stuff about me even being on TV, or we were dug in for the night, and I was busy. Sergeant had some duties he had to take care of, so I was there digging the hole, and I heard this big shell coming, with that high-pitched whistle kind of a whine, And man, it just got stronger and stronger. And you know, by the seconds, it comes right fast. Boy, I laid flat in that hole. I had it about half dug. That landed, oh, maybe 40 feet. That shell landed 40 feet from me. 40 feet isn't very far. And made a pretty good sized cone-shaped hole in their terrain. It kind of, I was half in and I was kind of half out of consciousness. And in digging that hole, I'd taken off my gear, like those heavy web belts that you hang grenades from and everything. I had taken that off and laid it on the edge of the hole. And of course, when that got so loud, I was right down in the bottom of that hole. That landed, and when I kind of got my senses back, I don't know how long that took, but I went to reach over and get my canteen, and everything I touched on that heavy web gear, I just touch it. It looked from normal. Just look. I'd touch it, and or I'd go to pick a little, and it had just turned into powder. Yet all the hardware and everything, it didn't blow it away. The concussion just turned into powder. And that night, there was two men to a hole, and one man was always awake all night. We would take turns. I'd be watching for 2 hours, listening, and be at the ready. And the other guy would lay down in the bottom of the hole best he could, because I was wrapped around his feet, and I'd done my watch, and I was trying to get a little shut-eye, and the sergeant was standing there doing his watch, and all of a sudden, I was just being walked on, and I was hearing him grunt, and a Jap soldier had crawled up, and it was a hand-to-hand situation.
And we know he lived to tell the story, but that story has taken on new meaning in this century for 97-year-old Durrell Gibbs. When we come back, you'll hear what he took away from that encounter, and eventually we'll hear about the incredible connection that would lead to decades later. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.